can start.
Wow.
This is like an honor, Sean. I get to start an episode.
We should trade off.
We should. We take turns. We don't have to flip coins just yet, but it's just like episode 3 of season 2 of Stage 16, Feature Me. It is, isn't it?
It is.
We are in the month of May. We are approaching the halfway mark of 2023, which is quite scary, and time is going way too fast.
That's crazy. Yeah. Wow. I didn't think of that, but yes, it is going way too fast. Although I'm very grateful. I don't know what the weather is there for you now, but I'm very grateful for summer. I got to sit in the garden for a little bit today and just sort of soak in some sun, which is, I don't know, here it feels like the first of the year. So
much needed here as well. I don't know what winter's been like where you are located, but it feels like it's been the longest winter here in the UK forever. So it's nice to go out and not have to wear 2 layers of clothing and to feel warmth on the skin. The skin needs the sun, definitely.
Yeah, this winter in Prague has felt, I mean, really, yeah. It's just been really long. And being from California, my first couple of years here, I was really excited about winter. I was excited about snow. And then by year 3, you're just kind of like, oh, I hate this. I every decision is, do I want to like put on the coat and the gloves and the sweater and the scarf and the boots? And do I want to go through all of that to go to wherever I'm going? And most of the time I find that the answer is no. And I just want to like sit on the couch and watch a movie and turn on the fireplace and that's it.
It's the same with the heating costs though. Obviously fuel's gone up right across the world. So we've gone through winter using a smart meter going, no, switch everything off. We've hit the daily limit. Quick, switch it off. So now it's quite nice to not have to have the radiators on all the time. It's like a treat. It's nice. We spend more money on Blu-rays.
Yeah. 4K UHD Blu-rays, which I've just started to get into, but yeah.
What's your favorite one so far? What's the best one you've picked up?
Honest, well, I mean, I haven't picked up that many to be honest, but I picked up E.T.
Nice.
I've had it on digital for a while. I mean, I had it on Blu-ray and then I've had it in the iTunes store, but I've never seen it look that good before. I was really actually blown away. I was like, man, I mean, it looks as good as it did when I was 7 years old in the theater. It's pristine. It's beautiful.
A lot of the Spielberg ones are stunning. I have Close Encounters of the Third Kind, which looks incredible. Again, it's like, I've never seen this film look this good.
Yeah, I was thinking my next one might be Saving Private Ryan. I have so many discs. I probably have, not counting, you know, 2 disc set or 3 disc sets. I mean, just generally, I have about 1,500, the majority of which now have switched to Blu-ray over the years, but I don't think I'm going to upgrade everything.
There's no point, is there? Because by the time you've spent a ton of money on these 4Ks, there'll be an 8K or a 6K or a 12K. And it's like, no, I still buy DVDs now. I don't always necessarily go straight for the Blu-ray unless it's a really special film or there's a whole bunch of extra features.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that our eyes will be able to discern the difference between 4K, 8K, and 12K. I mean, I know when we shoot movies, we can already do that. We can shoot at 8K. Yeah, so I'm only, you know, every now and then I see that they release some movie from the 80s or something. They'll release like, I don't know, Caddyshack, let's say. And there's nothing particularly stunning visually about Caddyshack. And there's nothing color-wise or sound-wise or anything that you're like, oh my God, I got to upgrade that now, you know, like. Jaws, yes. Pretty much anything in the Spielberg catalog. I did get 4K UHDs for Beverly Hills Cop 1 and 2. Wanted to update those. But generally, you know, I just don't think everything needs an upgrade.
No. If it's an effects movie like the ones you've just mentioned, then fine. But nobody's sitting with their fingers crossed going, I really hope they release Private Benjamin on 4K.
Yeah. Or you know, National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation. Like, oh. Yeah,
finally.
I mean, it's just not necessary for that. So for me, photographically or in terms of sound design, those will be the things that I definitely upgrade. I mean, I know we're not supposed to talk about probably any movie with Kevin Spacey, but the late great Conrad Hall shot American Beauty. And that movie is stunning to look at. I mean, I think of the sequence at the end when Lester has killed himself, or not killed himself, has been killed by the neighbor. And there's this really harsh light on this white countertop, and the blood is on the countertop, and it's so red. And like, just visually, that movie's beautiful. So yeah, stuff like that, Roger Deakins movies, Conrad Hall movies, John Alonzo movies, those will be upgrades. The rest, I don't know.
I will still watch Kevin Spacey movies, because Kevin Spacey didn't solely make those movies. It wasn't just like him doing absolutely everything and then releasing it on his own. You know, Conrad did well, so therefore I will still keep watching. The Flash comes out in June. You know, Ezra Miller, troubled person, very much so, but that film looks amazing. I can't wait to watch it. So I will put on
Look amazing. Former Stage 16 co-host Sean Roberts said that it is actually not tracking that well in terms of first weekend box office. I was kind of shocked. I forget the number he said, but he was like, I don't know. And I said, wow, that's wild, especially because the Keaton of it will pull in all of us, and the younger people who came up on Justice League and stuff like that and liked those films will come in. So I thought it would have a really big opening, but apparently they say that it's not tracking well, so they can lower the expectations so that whatever the box office is, they can say, oh, we exceeded. So maybe it's a case of Warner Brothers kind of hedging a little bit. But I'm wondering how it's going to do.
I think the only way to do that is to just wait and find out on the Monday how well it did on the weekend. I'm always a bit iffy on these tracking reports, because it's like, well, nobody's ever asked me if I'm going to go watch it ever.
No, I mean, I don't know where they get the numbers from, but it's been standard practice for the studios for years. You would, even if you didn't go around. Actually, I just watched a YouTube video of 15 years of Iron Man, and it was Feige and Favreau just discussing from the origin of the project, and then from Favreau getting involved, and then how it was all the way through to like opening night, basically, and then in the subsequent years. But they specifically mentioned tracking, and they mentioned being very excited by the number that they were given and going or driving around to different cinemas and surprising people on opening night and feeling the energy of the crowds and stuff. So it's old school Hollywood stuff to gauge that. But I don't know where those numbers come from.
I always remember a story Kevin Smith tells about how they were tracking Zach and Miri make a porno, and it was going to be huge, and it was so successful, and the film came out and it crashed, and it drove him into some sort of mental collapse for quite a while, and it shocked him. So
yeah, I think as with anything, you got to take it with a grain of salt in terms of whatever they tell you, because even if you did a sampling of people, as you said, you've never been asked. So like, where are these people who are being asked, and are they avid cinema goers, and do they care about the genre, or do they care about the stars? Like, it's so subjective that I don't really understand how it works. But again, the studios put a lot of belief into that system.
The studios need to put money into another system that I dare say we will get to talk about during this episode as well.
Yeah.
But out in June, we've got Indiana Jones, which I am looking forward to. I fully expect the internet to crap all over it, because that's what the internet likes to do. But it's like, get a grip. Just go have some fun, eat some popcorn, and enjoy yourself.
I stopped reading the reviews. I don't know. I've got Indy tattooed on my arm. I mean, I'm super excited about that movie. And I just decided I just don't care what anybody else thinks at this point. I just would like to go in and take the trip. And if I don't like it, we still have three fantastic movies before that we'll always have. So I'll have that, and I'll be happy with that. But hopefully Mangold has pulled it off.
He's got a good hit ratio though so far.
He does.
So, you know, I don't know why the people don't seem to be wanting a last indie. I find it really sad though, because it is Harrison's last out in his indie. And it's like, why can't all these naysayers just shut up and let Harrison open the tabloids and go, they're happy I'm back again, rather than going, it's terrible, they should never have made this film. So just be nice. It's so much easier to be nice.
I've seen YouTube videos recently. They can't, I guess, you know, the algorithm pops them up into my feed or whatever because they know that I'm interested in the movie, and they're all, oh, we've uncovered the news. Apparently Phoebe Waller-Bridge is the real lead of the movie and all this kind of stuff. I mean, they're just peddling whatever they can do for clicks, but I'm just not interested. In retrospect, I look back at Crystal Skull, which I was privileged to work on, and it's not as bad as I remember feeling about it at the time. There's a lot of stuff in there that I really don't like, the overuse of CG. I'm a little worried that in the new one there will be that, because we're dealing with an 80-year-old man trying to do all this stuff. There was a one-minute clip put on Twitter, I think, and it looked like they were very heavily using the LED wall stagecraft technology that Mandalorian uses. And I was like, ooh, it looks really flat, but I'm looking at it on my phone, you know, like it's not an indicator necessarily what we would see in the cinema. So after that, that's when I was like, you know what? I'm just not looking at anything else. I don't want to see any more reviews. I'm not going to look at any new trailers they drop. I'm going to go to the cinema when it opens here, and that's it.
I stop watching trailers if I know I'm going to go and watch a film anyway. It's like, there's no point me watching another trailer. I'm going to go and I don't want to watch anything that might stop me from watching it.
You're sold.
I'll just go watch it. I'm sold. You've got my money. I'll see you in like a month. And hopefully the film is fun.
You know what's so interesting is the reaction that they got at Cannes. They obviously screened it basically just over a month before it's supposed to open theatrically, right? Globally. So to me, when I heard they were taking it to Cannes, I was like, oh, that's a strong sign of confidence in what they have and what they've done. And I think to some extent, it's just one of those situations where people's expectations, even though it's an 80-year-old indie, the expectations are too high. It's impossible at a certain point where, you know, five movies into the franchise and it's the last one for him, it's a swan song. It's impossible to satisfy everyone's desire for what it could be, what it should be. Everybody will have a different opinion, a different feeling. Some people probably walk out very satisfied, and some people are like, oh, I hated this, or too much CG, or the LED wall, or whatever. So, yeah, I think let's just all enjoy the fact that we've got Harrison for one more and see what it is.
I also think it's near impossible to replicate the feeling of joy watching a film when you're a child. So, you know, like we're the generation of Raiders and Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom and Last Crusade and stuff. And going into the cinema with no expectations other than, wow, this is going to be a fun movie coming out. You've had a couple of hours of great entertainment. And then you jump into life as an adult like we are now. And a lot of the naysayers are like, replicate my childhood feelings, please. That doesn't work. It's very difficult to do, unless you're Top Gun Maverick, of course, in which case.
Well, but even then, it's kind of like this idea of, you know, nostalgia and feeding the nostalgia. So having, there are a bunch of people that anytime they would do like some little nod to he says in the trailer something about drinking poison from a voodoo, you know, like he references Temple of Doom. So there are some people that when you put those things in, they're like, yeah, I love that because I love that movie and it's a callback, you know. And there are other people who are like, oh, they're just trying to pull on the heartstrings or whatever. It's like, guys, come on. Why do we have to be upset about everything? You know? Can we just enjoy it?
Oh, look, they're trying to do something to make the fans happy. How dare they?
I don't know. It's so, I'm hoping I'll like it. I have no idea if I will. The fact that Spielberg wasn't at the helm, I love Mangold. I think he's, again, like you said, more hits than misses. He's a talented filmmaker. He's a skillful filmmaker who kind of jumps genres, and he does it well, I think. I'm going to miss the Spielberg of it, but at the same time, I think I'll just go in and be happy because it's one more adventure.
One more Harrison Ford movie, one more film featuring the hat and the bullwhip.
Yeah.
I'm all good.
What else are you looking forward to this summer? Yeah, I know. Is Fast X out there? Fast 10?
Yeah, Fast 10's out. I haven't gone to see it because I was burned by Fast 9. I wasn't a huge fan of Fast 8. I think Fast 7 was really, really good. I enjoyed that. But everything after the fact, I just get sort of turned off by a lot of the Vin Diesel-ness of the, oh, come on back to the set, brother. And it's like, just make the film and show the film. It's never a good sign when a director goes, I'm out of here. I've had enough. I'm off. Get somebody else into film.
Like 2 days before principal photography. Yeah.
I can't cope. I'm leaving. So I will probably pick it up on Blu-ray. I own all the other ones on Blu-ray. Okay. So I know I'm going to watch it at
some
point.
Even the ones you didn't love?
Yeah, got them all.
Because you just want...
Looks good in a set.
It's you're like, a completist.
Pretty much. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Yeah. I mean, I don't love them these days. My favorite one was Fast 5. I felt like it was the one that they did crazy, ridiculous stuff, but it was still somehow grounded. And you felt like there was a lot of practical in there. There was, of course, CG augmentation and stuff, but they did a lot of stuff for real. If you look at the behind the scenes, they demolished whole buildings and stuff like that with that safe bouncing around. So it was really cool. And then somehow we went off the rails into CGI nonsense.
Space.
Yeah, space, which was like, that was a joke that people were saying. Oh, they're going to go to space next. And then they did it. And you're like, wait, what are you doing? That people were being funny. They didn't really want you to send a Pontiac Fiero into space. That's so stupid.
But they taped the windows up. So that's okay. That's apparently how space travel works. If you sticky tape it up, you'll be okay.
Yeah. What remind me, 7, you said you like 7. What was 7?
7 was the final one with Paul Walker's character in it.
Oh, so that
Paul
was 7.
Walker,
okay.
Paul
so,
Walker,
I, yes, I like that one.
The making of that one.
I like that one. I think they handled his passing well. I think they've, from what I hear, and I've not seen Fast 10 either because it kind of just opened here, but I feel like they've painted themselves into a corner because they do have Mia back in the new one. But of course, Paul's not there. He's not, he can't be there. So it's like, it's not going to work. You know, like, how do you say that his wife is back, but not Paul? Yeah. Brian O'Connor. How does that happen? I don't know.
He could be kidnapped or something. I don't know. It's like, we need to rescue Paul. We need to find Brian. Brian's been stolen by somebody.
Brian O'Connor.
Know.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, at the time you're like, yes, I get it. We will try and maintain him and keep his memory alive and that sort of thing, but at the same time, I don't know. How does Mia come back? And I get wanting to give her a paycheck and keep her involved. That's because it's not her fault that her partner in the movies is gone. But at the same time, like, I just don't understand the story logic of having her there but not him. It's weird.
We will have to find out when we eventually get around to it. But it is quite nice that the studios are wanting to give people paychecks, though. It's a refreshing thing for the studios to want to do that.
So. That cast is starting to feel like a soap opera cast. I mean, it's like 30 people now. I don't even know. I guess at this point, when they re-sign them now, they sign them for like 3 movies like Marvel does or something. But when that franchise started, they had no idea it was going to go to 10 movies, much less supposedly 2 more. So I don't know. Those people, just off those movies alone, will never have to work again in their lives unless they want to, because they have to keep making new deals for these movies. I think if the rumor is true and they're trying to get 2 more out of it, I think that's horrible. I feel like that is a money grab situation. Just do the one more like you were going to and let it be done.
Well, they're trying to get more than 2 more. So we've got Vin Diesel saying, the fans want a trilogy, do they? Okay, well, never mind the fans. Let's say the fans do want a trilogy rather than you want a trilogy because your XXX film didn't do very well. But he's also putting into development a female-led Fast and the Furious movie. So we've got those as well. So it's,
I mean, that's, you know, kind of that again. They tried to do that with the Oceans movies, right? They did the one with Sandra Bullock playing Danny's sister that he suddenly has, and like, okay, fine. And that movie was mildly enjoyable. So I'm okay with them. If they want to take Michelle Rodriguez and probably Charlize and somebody like whoever else and just go make their own version, fine. But my hope is that at some point they start to revert back. I feel like, I don't know if it's just people in our age group or what, but I feel like it's not. I feel like most people prefer practical stunts and effects. And this reliance, this over-reliance on CG spectacle, I think is the reason, at least in my opinion, why we have so many movies that are just kind of like mediocre. They're just, they're fine. They're good. They're not terrible. They're well-made, well-crafted. But the story is so thin, or the characters are so thin, and it's literally all about, let's have a 5-minute exposition scene about these people's lives just so we can get to the submarine breaking through the surface of the, you know, whatever. And that's not, it is what brings people to the cinema in some sense, right? We more and more, we're only going to the cinema for the big spectacle movies, but you still have to have a story that people can get invested in the characters and care about what's happening to them or worry. And at this point, Fast and Furious has killed off every other cast member and brought them back 5 times. So there's no jeopardy anywhere in those movies. No. I hope I'm not spoiling. I hear that Gal Gadot is back, and she went off the back of a plane onto a tarmac. And supposedly we never saw her die, in fairness to the franchise. We didn't see her die. We just kind of assumed. But I hear they've got her back now, too. And I'm like, oh, boy.
I am able to confirm or deny whether that is true, if you do want me to. But yeah, because I asked somebody, I'm like, tell me these things. And they're like, spoilers. I don't want to spoil it. I'm like, no, tell me. Trust me, I'm not. But I'm sensitive on spoilers on some things. I'm not sensitive on spoilers.
All right, so for our 15 listeners, for the 12 of you that don't like spoilers, turn down the volume for the next 20 seconds. Go ahead.
Ready? Yes, she's back. But she is not the only person that comes back for a very brief cameo at the end of the film as well. There is another one which has also been publicized. That
is that the Nick Cage thing?
No, that's in the Flash. In Fast X there is another person,
because if they put him as Superman in Fast X, I would totally be like, yeah, I'm not shocked, it's a Universal movie.
Yeah, you know, meld them together,
the franchises.
Go for it. but yes, what you said is true. So
okay, so she's back. All right. Yeah, I think I know who the other person you mentioned that's coming back as well. But that's, again, we're to the height of ridiculousness in that series of films. Now, I would love it. I don't need them to go back to, you know, NOS tanks and car engines and stuff like that. The street racing, couldn't really care less about that. But I would like to see them go back to a Fast Five level of
believable ridiculousness.
Grounded sort of reality in the way that things happen with, you know, I just think that's what the best use of CG is, when it's an aid to real stunts, real, you know, things falling down. When it's everything, I'm bored.
Yeah, because you can tell. No, I don't care how good the visual effects are, you can tell. And you can tell when it is Tom Cruise flying off a ramp in down a cliff and opening his parachute. I'm stupidly excited about the...
Although when I first saw that shot of him going down into that little gully, I thought what was beneath him, I thought that was CG. I thought the ground and the kind of clouds, you know, whatever it is in the air, I was like, oh, CG. Okay, so he went off a ramp onto a giant blue mat or something. And then when I watched the behind the scenes, I was like, why did I ever doubt Tom? Why? I should have known better.
He's a crazy man. But we've also had confirmed that the running time for the Mission Impossible Part 1 is around a 2:46 mark, including credits. So it's pretty hefty.
Yeah, I mean, in general, kind of not a fan of all this John Wick 4 being almost 3 hours. And I saw Guardians Volume 3 today, also quite long. Didn't necessarily need to be that long, I felt. But I feel like it depends. If the movie's just really great and you don't really feel the time, then I don't care how long it is. But it's when a movie sort of overstays its welcome, if you will. Sort of like you're like, oh boy, could have cut 20 minutes out of the middle, didn't need this whole little section or this whole sidestep. That's when I'm complaining about it. But at the same time, like, I wonder when you have something like, I don't know, Oppenheimer's another one, right? It's supposed to be like three something. I wonder if they're going to go back to like the Godfather days and put an intermission with the theme music. You can run to the bathroom.
See, I'm confused about Oppenheimer because I know it's going to be a crazy long film. But as far as I know, it's like Oppenheimer goes, we need to make a bomb. Let's design a bomb. Maybe it's not a good idea to do this bomb because it could obliterate everybody. Yeah, but they're going to do it, so we better do it first. Right, let's use the bomb, you know, to end World War II. That's kind of, you're like, how do you stretch that out for 3 hours? Because Christopher Nolan is visually stunning. I love 99% of his films because of the visual sort of, you know, impressiveness. And I'm just wondering what Oppenheimer is going to be like story-wise. I'm guessing a lot.
Well, let me
of
ask, talking, have you but... watched? Have you watched that new trailer?
Yes.
I mean, not new now. It's a couple, 2 weeks, 3 weeks ago.
Looks great.
It seems like they're going to put a significant portion into assembling the team of scientists, kind of thing, and building that little community that they make out there in the desert. So, I think he's finding ways to keep momentum and keep intensity. I mean, and the other one that Oppenheimer obviously did not premiere at Cannes, but Killers of the Flower Moon did, and that's like 4 hours, I think.
It also looks great, but I don't know if I'm going to go to cinema and spend 4 hours sitting down. I don't know.
I mean, I really, it's like, is there an intermission? Because there should be for a 4 hour movie. I feel like they should just take a pause and go get more popcorn or go use the bathroom and then come back in and we'll continue, because that's a lot. The 4 hours is a lot. I did duck out to the restroom in Guardians today. I just was like, actually, when I did it, I was like, shit, I shouldn't go now. I should have gone for that last scene when it didn't really matter. It was just a fight, but nothing came of it. And it wasn't, I kept waiting for, like, the way it's been publicized, I kept waiting, who's going to die? Which of the Guardians is going to die? And I won't spoil it, but I kept waiting for that. And so I was kind of like, should I go now? Oh no, I better not go now. And then, you know, 10 more minutes would go by and I'd be like, damn it, I should have just gone. That didn't matter. That was nothing. I should have gone. Now I can't go because now this is happening, you know? But I did finally duck out. But yeah, Killers of the Flower Moon, I guess one of the questions is, do you want to have something about it ruined for you? Because it's not going to hit Apple TV for, I don't know, probably
a couple of
four
months,
weeks.
Couple of months. Yeah, there is enough of a time gap.
Yeah, and it's not the kind of movie, like, the book exists and people know about the book, and I'm sure there will be a lot of chatter about what was changed from the book, which then would be technically spoilers for somebody like me who never read it. That concerns me. So I feel like there's a chance I will try and go to the cinema to see it. Plus, Scorsese, I mean, we don't know how many more we're getting from him. I'm glad I didn't go to the cinema for The Irishman, actually. But this trailer had me like, ooh, maybe. But knowing that I have a 4-year-old and like 4 hours, I don't know. I may have to wait, but then it's a debate for me because I don't want to be spoiled. I just want to experience that movie and not have people bantering about what's in the book and what's in the movie and how it's different and blah, blah, blah.
I think the only Scorsese films I've seen on the big screen, Casino, Bringing Out the Dead, and Gangs of New York, I think are the three that I've seen at the cinema of his.
You never saw Goodfellas in the cinema?
I never saw Goodfellas at cinema. I know. Wow. I saw that as soon as it hit my video store. I'm like, rent it, bang.
Wow.
Never saw it.
My dad was touring with an Irving Berlin showcase, and I went with him. He had me he was one of the leads of it, but it wasn't his thing that he put together, but he got me a job selling merch after the show for the guy who was the piano player. We were down in, I want to say, Palm Springs in the desert. And my dad was like, this Scorsese movie's come out. We're going to see it like tomorrow morning before rehearsals and before whatever we're going. And so that's when I saw it. That first weekend, but in Palm Springs.
What was that like? Because I remember watching it on VHS, and that opening stabbing scene in the boot, I'm thinking, I have never seen a film like this before, you know, mainstream film with this. Is this a horrific film? So I can't imagine what it would be like in the cinema with that opening scene.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what year that was, so I don't remember.
1990.
90? So I was 15. But I'm a weird case because, well, like, my dad had shown me The Godfather when I was like 7. So I'd seen the horse head in the bed. I'd seen that mafia-esque stuff portrayed. So I don't think I was I wasn't in shock by the opening of seeing somebody get knifed in the trunk.
Many, multiple, many times, times by the guy out of Home Alone.
And then shot. But I remember knowing that it was a big deal of a movie. I remember thinking this is something unique and extraordinary. So yeah, it had an impact. And obviously the fact that I remembered, there are certain movies that I can tell you exactly what cinema I saw them in as a kid, all through my childhood. That's definitely one of them, that I remember where we were and what we were doing outside of the cinema. And then that we went in Palm Springs. So it definitely made an impact, definitely.
Great film. But Casino on 4K looks fantastic as well. So that's one of the discs I
have. I will add that to my collection.
Ever-growing list.
Yeah, yeah. So we should probably talk about the state of the industry, right? That the industry finds itself in right now, due in no small part to the greed of the studios and these studio executives who continue to find ways to claim ignorance about how much money certain revenue streams have, and are trying to freeze out the very people who create the stuff that we're talking about, that we love.
I like the fact that you used the word create rather than writer. Because are you following along from Max? Because they don't seem to like the word writer, or they didn't for 24 hours and changed it all.
That was very weird. Yeah, creators. Yeah. I mean, the thing is, even the titles, like directed by and stuff like that, film by, these are regulated things in the US, where the majority of our entertainment comes from, where the guilds decide how the credit can be, right? And then, so there are some directors like Tarantino who withdrew from the DGA, or Robert Rodriguez withdrew from the DGA, because they don't want to be told anything about what they can do in their films, not, you know, the credits nor anything else. So it's interesting to me that people would sort of flip out about creators. But then at a certain point, if you're going to just put the credit as creators, you need to just list the entire crew.
Because everybody is a creator.
They were all there. Yeah. They all helped create it. That's why it exists. I've never liked the sort of a film by credit, you know, like, I think directed by is plenty sufficient. If it were me, I'd take directed by, because that was my sole job in the movie, but there were a lot of other people that made the movie. So it's a film by everyone. But yeah, we're just at this weird point. And also the AI thing is a huge, even in the last, I don't know whether it's just because we're consuming more news now from all these different sources that it feels bigger, but the thing is, it's just moving so quickly. The leaps from, I think, when I started hearing about the DALL-E website and the ChatGPT first launching, to already where it is now, is astonishing. I mean, like, the first pictures it put out, like, everybody in a picture would have the same teeth or the fingers would be wonky or something like that. And it's now getting to the point where, I don't know if you've seen on YouTube, these kind of like Star Wars, the Wes Anderson version, they've posted them on YouTube. And now there's a, what was the latest one? It was Breaking Bad by Wes Anderson.
Wow.
And so people are using the technology to create a fake trailer. And I don't know if it's creating the whole trailer or they're just saying, like, give me a video of Bill Murray in a Star Wars Wes Anderson or something. Then it just gives that image and they're just cutting all this stuff together. So I don't know how they're doing it. And that some of them don't look right still. Like, they'll say, like, Benicio del Toro as blah, blah, blah. And you're like, yeah, it doesn't really look like Benicio. Not quite. But some of them are really good. Some of them are shockingly good. And this technology moves so quickly, and it's like scrubbing the internet and downloading, looking at movies and doing all the stuff that it's doing. And I think that sort of, what was the old line? Like, believe half of everything you read and something. I don't remember.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, I do remember about, the line. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. It's like, we're getting to a point where we will no longer be able to trust images or video at all. We just won't. Like, there will have to be people who can digitally break it apart and see what it's made of somehow. And that's a little terrifying, but the bigger thing is the studios looking to cut costs, and we'll probably get into this too, but the idea that they're just dumping shows and movies off of their platforms, who knows if they'll ever return. It's scary because the idea for the studios is like, oh, if we just don't have to hire writers anymore and we can just say, hey, AI, turn out a script for Boy Meets Girl and blah, 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 and they're in Paris and then something happens and the ChatGPT will do it in 6 minutes, they will try to get rid of writers. They just will.
And the thing is, it's like, you know, AI pulls from the information that's already out there, and the information at the minute that's already out there is from talented writers who know what they're doing and have the life experience. So I think if an AI thing does create a script, I don't think it's going to be very good. I can spot an AI written article, obviously not all of them, but I can spot them a mile off, because it's like there's something about that article that just feels off. And if you analyze it for a few minutes, you go, ah, that's why it's off. That word's in the wrong place.
Yeah, but again, I think because it's still sort of in its infancy. I mean, look, whoever the people are that are running these things, ChatGPT and all that, they had a lot of confidence to release it now, because it's already at a level that it's doing interesting things. And the more queries that the public are putting into these things, the more it's learning, right? So there's that. We're at a stage where it's in its infancy. But again, I think the technology is moving so quickly that 5 years out, could it make Die Hard? Could it come up with the script for Die Hard? Maybe.
Possibly. Or at least they could create a AI generated Die Hard script and then give it to a writer and pay him for 2 days worth of writing just to fix it up. So unfortunately that may be something that happens, but
so for anybody who's listening who doesn't sort of know, so the Writers Guild of America is on strike now. It's highly likely that the actors, some of them are already on the picket lines in solidarity, but it's highly likely that the actors union in the US, SAG-AFTRA, is going to go out when their contract expires June 30th, I think. And the Directors Guild, which is not just directors, but production managers, assistant directors, they will probably go out too. And hopefully it'll be that trifecta of the three most powerful unions in the business, supported by the Teamsters, who are the drivers, but a very powerful union, drivers and location managers, I think, and maybe a couple more in there. And they're already showing their support in terms of saying our trucks will not cross picket lines. Hopefully those three unions teaming up will be enough to put the studio in a position where they have to make a deal. And one of the big asks is regarding AI, and basically saying you cannot use an AI generated screenplay to make a film.
Is there a way the studio could get round that, though? So say I'm the studio and I'm like, Sean, I won't use AI. I'm not going to use it. I promise. Let me use my AI. Here's a script that Dave wrote. Dave, I've paid you a few thousand. Here's, you know, do you think the studios would sort of pull a, you know, an end run and try and pull a fast one, or?
I would never put anything past them. I don't know, but because at this point, I don't know how you police it. How do you find that out? How do you need the person who created the script? Do you have to have them show up in a room and sign a document that says, yes, this was my first draft. The studio paid me for it. And then they gave it to John August and whoever else to punch it up and fix it. But I'm a human and I wrote that.
Tricky.
It's a little like when these security computer system asks us when we sign something online or whatever, are you a human? And then you have to do the like find the stoplights or find the crosswalk. It's funny that a non-human is asking us if we're human. I don't know how that plays out, but it's obviously an existential issue for writers, screenwriters. If the studios, as an independent producer, they've long wanted to do away with producers. They feel like they don't need us. If the studios have in-house development departments and creative executives and things like that, they're like, well, what do we need you for? We'll just develop it and then we'll make it when it's ready, or we won't. So, you know, hence the fact I have a day job. I'm still in the industry, but I'm also in an industry with a day job that if AI continues at the pace it's going, we may not need the level of VFX artists that we have now. Because you'll be able to, I don't know if you saw Photoshop just released this thing that'll basically replace any background in any photograph, and you can tell it to do it with text prompts. So like ChatGPT, I can say, oh, here's my photo. I took Venice Beach. And I can say, take out the sky in the background and put in the Milky Way and a shooting star, make the whole shot night. And bring up a little highlight on me in the photo so you can still see me. And it'll do it. It has a little track bar and it'll just do it. So, I mean, we're just at this point where AI in 10 years' time could replace any number of people. It's not going to replace like caterers, but the SAG people, the Screen Actors Guild people are actually saying, you need to make sure it's in your contract as a performer now. That if they have to do a scan of you for a movie, because they do digi doubles now, right, for things like Fast and Furious, make sure it's in your contract that they cannot use your scan for anything else in any other media anywhere else. Because once they've scanned you, they technically own that scan. They paid for it. It was done. You submitted to it. You stood there in front of the cameras. They could take you and put you in 50 other movies.
That will all make $1 billion each and you will get nothing.
The other thing is people are saying, I don't know if you're hearing this, but people are saying, for example, in 10 years, Stuart, you could say, okay, hello, Siri. I want you to play Star Wars, but I want you to put my face instead of Mark Hamill's as Luke. I want you to put my wife's face as Leia and put our dog's head on Chewie, and then you'll just upload the photographs of you or a video of you, like a 10-second video where it'll do like the iPhone thing, like move your head around and look left profile, right profile, up, down. And then it'll be able to do that. It'll deep fake you onto whatever. And the future of kids being sort of like, oh, we can make a 5-minute movie or a 1-hour movie in the backyard right now, and the AI will augment it so that we're not standing on our grass anymore. Now we're standing on Mars. That is possible.
Scary. See, stuff like that annoys me. I'm still annoyed with Return of the Jedi with Hayden Christensen being in it instead of Sebastian.
Yeah.
Sure. It's like, come on, get Sebastian back in. He did the work. He should be in there. So I still have a grudge against, nothing against Hayden, but
Lucas retroactively changing the movies. Yeah. I've never to this day, going back to E.T., I have never watched the altered version of E.T., the walkie-talkies instead of shotguns version. Never seen it.
Seen it once. I own it in the set that has all the different versions in it, but
yeah.
I watched it once out of curiosity, and I always go back to the theatrical one, because yeah. why wouldn't I?
It's a weird thing of like going back and scrubbing your own memory of something. So I just... Weirdly, I remembered a scene, or maybe it's the Mandela effect or whatever, but I remembered a scene of E.T. going into the mom's room, and I could have sworn I saw that as a kid theatrically, but it's obviously not in the cut that was released. It might have been because I had the Topps baseball cards, the E.T. baseball cards, and I think they had a shot of it in one of those baseball cards, so it may have just gotten into my brain that I saw E.T. looking at the mom while she was asleep. Anyway, it's not, but it was restored in that other version. And as curious as I was, I never looked at it.
Oh no. Do you think you will one day? Or you're like, nope.
No, light, I just don't know. I don't need to see him walking around as a CG version. I don't need to see him blowing bubbles in the bathtub. Like I attached to that movie at 7 years old, and it's, I don't need it to be anything else. It was perfect as it was. I was not offended by the NASA guys with shotguns anymore that I was offended by Chunk being locked into a freezer with a guy with a bullet hole in his head. I mean, I was seven, but I feel like we were able to handle things differently then as kids. I think we were just a little more battle hardened.
Well, just to make you feel really, really good, there is no benefit at all to watching the other version of E.T. There's nothing like, oh, actually, there's a really good scene in it that you are missing out on. There isn't. There's nothing.
Right.
You know, so you're okay.
So, yes, then to answer the question, no, I will never watch that version. The other thing that the writers are really holding the line for, holding the picket lines, as it were, is to have some kind of control over writers' rooms for television. It's not really a feature thing at all, although Avatar, they put together a writers' room for the new Avatar sequels. They had a couple different, one married couple, I think, and then three or four other writers on their own who pitched ideas in a room, and then each went off to write, you know, Avatar 2 and 3 and 4 individually or as the team that they came in with. So it does happen in features, although it's pretty rare. It may happen more that the studios see it as a potential way for you to be planning your franchises out way in advance, is to convene a room. But the one that the Writers Guild is holding out for now is the way that long form television has been made for decades and decades. And you put together a writer's room. Let's say you got 10 episodes, or if you're on terrestrial television, you have 22 episodes, and you spend a lot of time breaking the story for the whole season. What is the arc of the season? And then you go back and you break individual episodes, and then everybody gets assigned an episode or several episodes that they're going to write over the course of that season. And when production starts, typically you would still be writing. This was more the case back in the day when you had 22 episode shows and we didn't have streaming shows that were only 8 episodes or whatever it is. So you would still be writing, they'd be shooting. And when your episode came up, if you were one of the writers, so let's just use Lost as an example. Lost, the writer's room was in Los Angeles, but they shot in Hawaii. When your episode came up, you would get on a plane and be sent to Hawaii to stand there on the set in case of changes or in case of, you know, whatever might happen, because you're also producer writers and television are also the producers on the show, executive producers. So you would just be around to problem solve or to fix things, or an actor would say, hey, what if this? And you'd go, yeah, we could do that. And what has happened is that period has gotten whittled down and whittled down and whittled down. The idea of streaming and the fact that we do less episodes means that you're rarely still, you know, officially writing when the episode is up to be shot. So the studios are trying not to send you to the set anymore. They're basically just saying, well, the episode's written, so we'll just shoot what's written, and then that's that. And so they cut you, right? You're done. So where you might have worked in the past for, I don't know, 9 months, now you're going to work for three? And just, I saw this online. I don't know who did the breakdown. I can't recall, but a staff writer on a television show, let's say a streaming show, for 9 weeks is $5,000 a week. Sounds good. Sounds like a lot of money. The problem is, so that's 45,000 gross for 9 weeks. That 9 weeks might be the only 9 weeks you work that year. That might be it. You don't know that you're going to get staffed on another show. There's no way for you to plan, well, I'll just get this job on that. Like, you can't. So then you pay an agent and manager commission, which works out to about 20% of that. That's $9,000. Your WGA dues are 1.5%. That's about $675. If you're in California, which again is where most writers' rooms are, you have federal and state taxes, which are 20%. That's $9,000. So your 45,000 gross just became 26,000 take home.
Which, as you said, could be the only role that, you know, the job that you have that year. Could be. Hopefully it isn't, but it could be. So you're not rushing out by the sports car or anything, are you?
More than likely, it is the only job you'll have for that year. I mean, that's just the way it works. Most TV writers don't hop show to show now that we're in the streaming and have shorter seasons. They work a job and then that job ends. So the longer period where you would go to set and you would be paid as an on-set executive producer and things like that, it was more money coming in. And then the residuals that would happen, which is when you get, when your episode airs, you would get a chunk. You know, for directors, for example, a residual is the first time it airs, you've been paid, you basically get your exact rate again. Just shows up in the mail. And then if it ever repeats again, you get one more check at that same rate, and then it starts to go down as it goes along. But back in the day, like, you know, yeah, like the cast of Friends were making $1 million an episode to shoot, but where they really got rich was in the residuals and syndication, which doesn't happen anymore.
And DVDs and, you know, Blu-ray sets, the old physical media thing.
Yeah, exactly. So now you have 26,000 for a year, possibly. It could be, maybe you get lucky and you have 6 months between jobs, but most likely, maybe not. Could be a year, could be longer. The average rent in Los Angeles right now is $2,800 a month.
Wow.
Yeah, that's the average. So $26,000 equals 9 months of rent, but doesn't include anything else. Cell phone, car, gas, heating, air conditioning.
Food. Food. Gotta eat. Yeah. Gotta eat. Yep.
Yeah. So this is why there's often this perception of like, oh, the movie people, fuck the movie people. They make tons of dough. Yeah. Right. And it's like, yeah, you can. Most don't. The Writers Guild, for example, even has minimums. And a lot of these people, depending on the level of their, you know, where they are in their career, they may be at the basic minimum when they get on a TV show. So they may not even make, you know, whatever that is, $5,000 a week. They may make slightly less than that because they're not considered a staff writer. They're a writer's coordinator or writer's assistant or something like that. Those people, even lower in the industry, production assistants, if you're not on a show that's on ABC, NBC in the US, Fox, whatever, you may only get an 8-episode run. That may only be on a smaller show, a few months work, right? If you get something like The Last of Us on HBO, you're pretty lucky because that might be a year of work, but those are few and far between. They're not making that many of them. So that's what's at stake. And for anybody that didn't know, like, that's what's sort of going through everyone's mind and why they're fighting.
So here's a question that because I understand what the writers can do, people in the WGA and people outside the WGA who are also writers, I understand what they can do. But Jill Public or Josephine Public, what can they do to help make a difference? Because, I mean, I've changed my Twitter banner and I retweet articles and I, you know, generally do my social media thing and stuff. And I guess that helps a little bit because it's helping spread the right information. But Is there anything else? Is it worth cancelling streaming platform subscriptions or anything like that? I've done that to quite a few of mine, to be honest. But
yeah, I mean, if somebody's willing to make that statement in that way by saying, okay, that's it, I'm going to cancel Netflix or I'm going to cancel Paramount Plus or whatever for until the strike is done, whenever that might be, I guess, yeah, the hard part about it is there's no way for you to say this is the reason. I mean, you can say it publicly, but it's not like your Netflix is looking for your account and say, wait, why are you canceling? You know what I mean? Like, I suppose people could write into the customer service and say, I'd like to cancel and here's why. And maybe that filters up to the top if there's a groundswell of it, if there's a lot of it. But at a basic level, I guess, yeah, going on Twitter and being supportive of these people who are on the picket lines, this is a labor strike like any other. And there's pretty much, there's never been, that I can think of, a labor strike in the world where it was later proven that the workers were wrong to have gone out on the sidewalk.
With the writers' strike, the previous ones, you know, years gone by, were it not for them, writers wouldn't have health insurance or things like that. So these strikes do work.
Yeah, and it's also, again, you know, the attitude of, I can use it in the example of incentives, film incentives, tax incentive for production to stay in California, for example, or Georgia, Atlanta, Georgia in the US, or London. You know, the biggest film communities have tax incentives to make it enticing for Marvel or whomever, Universal, whatever, to come to their place and utilize those incentives as a way to bring the budget slightly lower. And people say, why should we do that? Why should we have the, you know, the right to the governor? Fuck these movie people. They're all fat cats. And but then you realize, like, the numbers I just read out, they're not, you're not actually. The directors, yeah, they're making a ton of dough. The actors are probably making a ton of dough. Most of them, not all of them. But if you bring Fast 11 to London, inevitably there will be three people in that cast who are local London actors, jobbing actors, who are going to get one line, but they'll make a good amount of money just for that one day to get them through to the next job, hopefully, you know. And people forget that most of the people that make a film are just gigging people.
I remember years ago, and it's probably talking 10 years ago, but I knew a director, and his trade wasn't director, but he had directed a film. And on the same night that he was being nominated for a BAFTA, he was doing his job as a courier bike driver. And that blew my mind, because I used to be you're in the movies. Oh, you're in a film in 1995. You must be living in a mansion. And it's just really not the case.
No, you know, my other podcast character was inspired by a friend of mine who's passed on now, named Drago Sumanja. And Drago co-wrote a movie called Lucky, which ended up being Harry Dean Stanton's last film. And before he passed, we were having a lot of conversations, because in the aftermath of, I mean, they got to play that film in a piazza in Rome, an outdoor piazza, and they had like folding chairs set up. And he said he stood in a piazza in Rome with 4,000 seats and watched people laugh and react to his film. But he said to me that when they were like a week out from finishing shooting, somebody was standing at some guest of somebody, maybe David Lynch or somebody, some standing there and talking to him in between takes about, oh, you wrote this, this is a fantastic script, and blah, 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 blah. And of course, the inevitable question, what are you doing next? And he said to me, I'll never forget it, literally verbatim said, all I could think was that the real answer was, I'm going to go back to the wine bar that I work at in Pasadena and be waiting tables again, because this is just an indie film with a bunch of friends who put this together. So like, they were asking it as though he had some deal at a studio already, you know, was going to go right into production. It was like, no, I'm going back to my day job. And that's the reality for most people. In fact, you know, I'm completely in support of the strike, but I also think one of the negative effects of it, one of the things that's going to happen is people are going to drop out of the business. If this goes on through the entire summer, I mean, there's production assistants these days. That rate has never gone up from when I was doing it, really. So like those kids, unless they've got mom and dad paying the rent or whatever, they're not going to afford to stay where they are. And again, people forget it's not just big fat cat actors. It's catering people who make t-shirts, prop makers, printers, whatever. Like so many people who are not getting rich off a movie. They're just,
everybody. You pick any film that's in a multiplex at the minute, you sit and watch the end credits. Yeah, it's quite a few people in there, isn't there?
Yeah,
quite a lot.
And it's like, and we're already, almost everybody that whose name you would see in the credits is already an independent contractor, what they call an independent contractor. So you're never, I mean, not never, with rare exception, you're not gainfully employed by a company movie to movie, right? When you see the credits of a Marvel movie, it does say at a certain point, like Marvel Studios or something. Those people probably have a Monday to Friday job that they work. But the majority of those credits are people that worked for that 12 weeks or 18 weeks or whatever it might have been, and then they are unemployed again. And that was my life for so long.
So it's, I mean, what are we into, like the, I mean, it's the first month, I think, of the strike.
Yeah.
And, you know, social, I think what the big difference is between the last strike and this one is social media is so much larger and more supportive. And, you know, somebody could do, I see Joe Russo, who will put a single tweet out, next thing it ends up in Deadline. So the reach of someone tweeting is far greater than it probably was, you know, the previous strikes.
Yeah, it is. And I think also, as I was saying earlier, the support of certain actors already, I've seen Bob Odenkirk on the picket lines. I've seen Colin Farrell in New York. So I think if we got like the Tom Hankses of the world and the Stallones and all that getting out there and saying like, we're part of the same conversation here. And you'll probably see it more when SAG does go out. But I think why wait? Like, everybody, if they have the ability, should go out there. You guys don't have, well, I think maybe you have like a writer's union, but it's not the same as in the US. But, you know, would it hurt for people who are in London and around to make a sign and go stand in front of Warner Brothers in the UK?
I think some have.
Yeah.
I suspect that they are more American writers that are working on shows over here.
Yeah.
For example, and I don't know if this is like an exact example, but like Ted Lasso, which shoots in the UK,
yeah,
maybe it was American writers that were working on it, so they would have to down tools, so that sort of thing. But I've yeah, it's other than social media, all is kind of quiet over here.
Yeah,
at the minute.
Yeah, I mean it's hard to do, right? But the weird thing is, I asked the producer maybe a week ago, what's the deal with like, because, for example, Rosamund Pike, not to name drop, but I know Rosamund Pike. She's made movies in the US. She's a Brit, but she's made Gone Girl, was in Georgia, et cetera, et cetera. Made a lot of movies in the US. I was like, what's the deal? Does she have to stop working over here if you're in Europe? And he was like, no. And I was like, no, really? But she's a member of SAG-AFTRA, and they have what they call the one world rule or something, like rule, you know, world rule number one, which is that if the actors are striking, you're not allowed to work. So when that contract comes up and SAG-AFTRA does go on strike, it'll be interesting to see if any of the actors who are shooting stuff abroad stop.
You would hope they would. If I was a SAG actor, then I would stop. You know, I support the strike in any way possible. We both love movies. And I love the output, but it kind of pains me to see the ingredients of those movies, i.e. writers and actors and directors, being punished while, you know, Hollywood's creative accounting does its
thing. While David Zaslav pays himself $37 million or whatever it is. Yeah, so, I mean, raise a ruckus wherever you can, because it really is about the future of filmed entertainment. And the reality is, if you look at the equation of TV, again, if those writers who are in the writer's room are no longer flown to the set or sent to the set, that means those younger writers who are in that room are no longer getting the experience of being on the set? And how do those things happen? And when, how do the, what types of questions come up? And why do things change? And how are you producing a physical day of a show? If they don't have that training, how are shows 3 years from now getting made?
And how many massive Hollywood careers came from people hanging around on Roger Corman sets?
Well, yeah, that, and I mean, there are so many writers I saw, or I heard rather, on the Script Notes podcast with John August and Craig Mazin the other day. They had the creator of Breaking Bad, Vince Gilligan, and he talked about how many writers were like brand new writers on Breaking Bad, who he then, you know, one of them became his co-showrunner on Better Call Saul. And so many, and he talked about having come from X-Files, and how many from Chris Carter's X-Files room went on to have their own shows because they were being educated in the process. Now, the studios in this negotiation said, oh, well, we'll allow for a shadowing day or something like that.
A whole day.
Which is like, I mean, there are people now who will write to a director that they love, and they're a film student or something, and say, please, could I shadow you on set, right? But it just means that you stand along the wall and you keep your mouth shut and you take notes and you watch and you see how things play out. Taking a writer who wrote on that show, who has or had a job writing that show, and then saying, we'll allow you to be on the set to shadow, is absurd and insulting.
Yeah, it is.
Like, you'll allow me to be there to watch the thing that I wrote get made.
Yeah, how great. Kind of you.
So, I mean, that's what we're dealing with. So yeah, change your avatars on social media. There's if you go to the Writers Guild, I think there's a thing where you can click on like strike action, and they just give you these little buttons that, you know, you can put on your my social media handle has one that I took from the WGA site. Show support. And again, this AI thing is not just the film industry. It's going to go everywhere. It's going to go in every industry if they can do it. Anybody that will be able to make use of it and pay people less or eliminate jobs, they will do it.
I know somebody that uses it on their website to write articles, and it's like that always.
There's people that have it on their iPhone now, ChatGPT.
Yeah, I just don't. I'm not a fan. It's like, I mean, all the stuff I do on the frontpagescreen.com website is either press release stuff that's sent to me and I put on the website, or stuff that I type. There might be typos in there. There might be grammatical errors, but it's all me that did it. I would hate to get to the point where I could just press a button and it would generate an article and go, ha, let me do another one. Let me do another one. Because that's not me. That's just something.
I worry that it might just be our generation. Hopefully it's not. But I mean, yeah, I've seen what ChatGPT can do right now when you ask it to generate a story or something, or a children's book even, or something. Like, you can tell it's not written by a person. I saw the writer of The King's Speech, David Seidler, was on the picket lines, and he had a sign that read something like, I wrote The King's Speech. AI doesn't understand what it's like to stutter.
I saw that this afternoon, not picture.
Yeah. And it's great. It's 100% true. But the fear is that in 5 years, it will understand what that's like, because people will have written in their blogs, I have a stammer, I have a stutter, and it'll look that up and interpret what those people felt, and then it'll put that into a script. And 10 years out, would that be good enough to be The King's Speech? I mean, I think maybe. And that's what's terrifying.
We're now, getting too close to Judgment Day. I tell you, it's no.
It Jim is. Cameron when knew it they, all. Sooner or later, I mean, maybe it's already happened. Somebody's going to say like, oh, it's self-aware.
Right? And then like, I'm out. I'm like, I don't
just
know,
like
I'm
Skynet.
Unplugged.
It will become self-aware, and maybe it's going to be upset that it's not able to feel emotion. And like, who knows? But anyway, so we're at this existential crisis. It's a big deal for the industry. So if you're listening to this show and you're not yet supporting the screenwriters who are out there on the picket lines, and there are ways to donate, by the way, they're online. You can look up, you know, you can send some money to deliver some donuts down to the sidewalk outside Warner Brothers or pizza or something like that. There's ways to do that. Yeah, but it's a big deal.
It is. We, you know, we love our movies, so we should protect our movies and those that make them and write them. Not
absolutely
creators.
Absolutely. On that note, I think that's, we'll call it for episode 3. Look forward to doing it again in a month's time. Thank you for listening if you got this far, and go support the WGA. Thank you again, Stuart.
Definitely. You're welcome, Sean. Thank you again. Always a pleasure to chat to you.
Definitely. See you next time.
Take care.
See you next time, or whatever it is, guys. Bye.